It begins in infancy as an impulse. It grows and develops as an idea through trial and error. Then, through experience, it goes into a state of being. And left untreated, it can remain with us for our entire lives. And it can even become a way of life. An infant knows no other way to communicate. An infant has a need and it wants relief now. It wants satisfaction now. It wants to be cared for now. It's hungry or sitting in a dirty diaper and it will communicate with tears, with crying, with loud wails. It wants attention now. It wants relief and satisfaction now. Well, as the child grows into adolescence, that attitude can still be there. I want this. I want that. Get this for me now. How many of you have been in a grocery store and you've seen little people dragging their parents all around? I want this. I want that. You're not giving it to me. They throw themselves on the ground and start kicking and wailing because they want it now. They want it now. They're demanding and they throw tantrums. Well, given a few years, and though maybe less vocal or less circumspect, knowing the game of parent manipulation, young people can still exhibit the same thing. But the ante has been raised. The ante has been raised. Now it's fashion and music and friends and cars and stuff in general. See, once it starts from infancy, it grows. But the attitude, still there. It's like boys and their toys. Little boys with their toys are small. Older boys, our toys are just more expensive. By adulthood, we've become masters of it. We've become so used to it, we don't even think about it. We don't see it. We don't know it's in the way of our own spiritual growth. It's part of us. Well, I'm talking today about having a self-centered, me-first, demanding attitude. An attitude where our plans, our purpose, our intentions take precedent over everything else, even over the plans of God. Today we're going to search the scriptures to gain a much deeper insight into the nature of a self-centered attitude so that we can be aware of it when it rears its head and understand the attitude and how to avoid this basic display. But because it can be hard. I work in the world of demanding people and I see this constantly. People posturing for power and position and their way. Even when their way may not be the best, they want their way. Let's begin by reviewing a very simple incident between Jesus Christ and one of the disciples. Clearly illustrates this point. One of our favorite disciples, Peter. Turn over to Matthew 16, please. Matthew 16. Matthew 16, verse 21. Here, Jesus Christ is teaching his disciples. This is what's going to happen. This is what's coming down. This is going to be my history. This is what will happen. I'm letting you know history in advance. This is the plan that the Father and I have put together. This is what we've agreed to. Verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. He was sharing what's going to take place. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you." But he, Jesus, turned to and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of man." Now the word rebuke, Peter rebuked Jesus Christ. The word rebuke means to criticize, disapprove, or censure. Whoa, Peter, in all his enthusiasm, was censuring, criticizing the Christ. He knew him to be the Christ. He didn't have God's Spirit. And he took him aside and admonished him. And the implication of the word admonish means that he would forbid him for this to happen. And as Jesus explained, you aren't thinking according to our plan. You're thinking according to your way. What Jesus was describing to Peter didn't fit with Peter's ideas. Did not fit in the way that he, Peter, thought things ought to be. This is the Christ. He should take control of the life of life around us. Peter missed the point. He had a certain belief as to the way things were supposed to go. And Peter was taking exception to the events as laid out by Jesus Christ in full agreement with God the Father. Jesus was trying to help the disciples understand that things were not going to go as they expected. And Peter was not prepared to accept this. So he rebuked Jesus. How about you? But it's probably high on my list. Number one, don't rebuke my boss. You know, it's part of my employment contract. Don't rebuke my boss. I 34 years now, close to it. I haven't done that yet. I don't see the value. I've corrected my boss gently, with humility, but I've never rebuked my boss. Jesus had to take Peter to task, saying, "You are not mindful of the things of God. You're still thinking on a physical level. You're still thinking on man's level. You don't see the big picture. I'm letting you know what's going to happen tomorrow. You're telling me I can't do what I need to do today." Jesus went on to explain some things. Verse 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." It's a different attitude, different philosophy. Here Jesus was saying that he understood that each disciple has an idea of what they want and what they expected. But what they needed to understand is how things were really going to be. It was going to be different than your expectations. In the end, it was all boiled down to, "I don't follow you. You follow me." It's hard sometimes to accept the way things turn out in our lives. We don't count on things happening in our lives the way they do. We hope that they don't happen a certain way, but sometimes they do. And it's very important to keep things in the right perspective, and it's not easy to do so. Events and situations can affect us for the entirety of our lives. And all too many times, it's negative. And it's hard to get away from that negativity. No better way of saying it than, we are a self-centered people. From infancy all the way to adulthood, we live a self-centered life. It's about us. It's about our needs. It's about what we expect. We expect so much from other people. We expect things from our spouses. We expect things from our parents. We expect things even from God. We expect certain things from God, from the church, from the people in the church. We are self-centered in most of our areas of our lives. And it's God's Spirit in us that is pushing that away so that we become other-centered, God-centered. Because things don't turn out the way we want or expect, we can end up angry, frustrated, judging others, critical of others, even being critical of God. Maybe not right out. Maybe not with those words, but certainly behind the words and behind the actions. Remember, the people went against Moses, and what did God say? People went against Samuel. What did God say? He said the people were actually against him. We can turn our anger and blame on someone or something else, and too often the anger and blame we have is toward God. We just don't see it. We aim it at people or institutions when we're really displeased with how things are in our lives and we want to blame God. As children, we expect certain things from our parents. We expect love. We expect correct treatment. We expect certain things from our employers, from our friends. We expect things from all around us. There are a lot of things we just demand in our lives that just don't happen. Parents don't always get what they demand from their children. Children don't always get what they demand from their parents. You don't get what you demand from your boss or your employer or your spouse. We demand that slow drivers get out of our way. Am I the only one? Probably not. Probably not. We demand that shopping lines that people in shopping lines have their coupons out. Or at least have your money out and don't go searching your purses, ladies, looking for those pennies. It's okay to have change. 10 minutes looking for change really frustrates me. Just saying. We want everything marked correctly. We don't want to go and buy something and have it marked incorrectly and then have that inconvenience. We want everything we need readily available. We don't want to go to a store and find you're sold out because I waited three weeks and you've had a sale on for 4 weeks. There are many ways we become a demanding person. Overall, we expect life to go a certain way, and when it doesn't, it's a source of frustration. A frustration that can be defined as a combination of anger and discouragement. I don't think I'm speaking out of school here. I think all of us at some time in our lives have experienced this. When things don't go as we planned or as we expect, we can embrace that self-centered attitude and we can become a people of demands. Some may become indignant when things don't turn out the way they think they should. Why didn't things happen the way I want them? Why didn't things happen as I expected? I can think of 1,000 reasons or 1,000 things in my life that I'm thankful, looking back, didn't happen the way I demanded or expected. The Israelites had to face this. They were in a situation where they were convinced that God had somehow mismanaged everything. Whoa, it's even hard to even say that. Where they thought God had mismanaged everything. He got them out into a place that would mean disaster for everyone. I'm talking Numbers 9. I think I've used this before, multiple times, because it just lends itself to so many salient spiritual points. They were angry and they were upset. And that was the issue all along. They were angry. They were taking it out on Moses, but they were angry with God. What'd you take us to the desert to die for? Didn't we have all the food we ever wanted to eat there? We had freedom. Whoa, we were slaves. We were in starvation diet. They told us when to get up, when to go to bed. But all of a sudden, that was so much better than being under the hand of God and having your God, the sovereign of the universe, leading you into the promised land, as it were. They were angry with God. Moses was just accessible. This goes back to how we make choices in our past. We had a plan, and on that we had an expectation, and we discover that all of a sudden we're on a different path, and we have to trust God completely, having confidence in God that He knows what He's doing. Now remember, Israel had centuries to step away from God, not understand God. And He needed to teach them who He was and that He was their God. They were His people. He needed to teach them. God freed Israel from bondage and then exposed them to inconvenience and trial. He wanted a major lesson to be learned. Numbers 9, and I know I've used this example before, but it's such a powerful one. Because when I get into situations where I wonder what's happening in my life, I have to remember this example here. Numbers 9, verse 15. Now on the day that the tabernacle was raised up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony. From evening until morning, it was above the tabernacle like the appearance of fire. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, after that the children of Israel would journey. And in the place where the cloud settled, there the children of Israel would pitch their tents. At the command of the Lord, the children of Israel would journey. And at the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud stayed above the tabernacle, they remained encamped. Even when the cloud continued long, many days above the tabernacle, the children of Israel kept charge of the Lord and did not journey. Verse 20, so it was. I love that phrase. So it was. So it was when the cloud was above the tabernacle a few days, according to the command of the Lord, they would remain encamped. And according to the command of the Lord, they would journey. So it was, when the cloud remained only from evening until morning, when the cloud was taken up in the morning, they would journey, whether by day or by night, whether the cloud was taken up, whenever the cloud was taken up, they would journey. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud remained above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would remain encamped and not journey. But when it was taken up, they would journey. At the command of the Lord, they remained encamped. At the command of the Lord, they journeyed. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. What was he saying through all this? It's a simple explanation with a very specific intent. What do you suppose God was doing? It appears clear. When I move, you move. When I stop, you stop. Israel probably didn't like this. By day or by night, the time could be inconvenient. You put the kids to bed. You just settle down. You put the tent up. You get everything nicely laid out. You wake up in the morning. The cloud is moving. Ow! I got to pick up everything and got to go. So the next time the cloud settles, you keep everything in boxes. You're ready to go. I did this at work. They moved me around. I had 8 boxes in my cubicle for 2 years. By the time I actually got to them, none of the stuff in the boxes made sense anymore. I had to throw it out. So you got the boxes ready. The cloud moving? No. Cloud moving? No. Okay. Next morning, cloud moving? Cloud moving? Well, who knows? It could have been a month. Then you finally start taking things out of the boxes. There goes the cloud again. God was saying very clearly, I am God. I'm in charge. And how often we think, by being human beings with our own rational thinking, we can make our own decisions of morality. God's in charge. God's in charge. God was teaching that He is in charge, that He was the human, the guide of human beings. He was moving them from the physical, from Pharaoh, from the overseers, from slavery, to being the people of God, having a spiritual guide and leader, which ultimately they still rejected. It's important to understand that the beginning of a proper response to frustrating circumstances is a clear recognition of who is in charge. The beginning of a proper response to frustrating circumstances is a clear recognition of who is in charge. When you're going through a difficulty, I like going to bottom line. I just love this. If I can deal with the bottom line, I can go forward. The bottom line for all of us is God is in charge. If you don't believe that, you're going to be frustrated when situations happen in your lives that are difficult. But God is in charge. There's numerous scriptures here that says, I know my thoughts toward you, thoughts of peace and a hope of the future. I only think good thoughts toward you. I'm offering you salvation. I'm offering you eternity. There's a whole book here on how God thinks about us. It's the beginning of a proper response to frustrating circumstances is a clear recognition of who is in charge. When we enter into situations that are frustrating, we try to remind ourselves that God really loves us, that we have an awareness of God's love, and that awareness casts out fear. We must also recognize that we are subject to God's will, and that deals with our self-centeredness. We want things a certain way. We have to have things a certain way. And God says, no. I have a love and care for you. I want you in my kingdom. I'm leading you. I'm allowing things to happen in your lives that is going to change you so that you can be in my kingdom. There's a song out, Thank God for Unanswered Prayer, some country western thing. I think back to the thousands of things in my life, and especially in my early years in the church, that I asked, wanted, demanded, and I'm so grateful that never came about. Because I certainly would have been a different person today. An important part of our relationship with God is to understand that He is God, and we do as He says. He loves us. He has the best in mind for us. And we must trust Him that He only allows that which is good for us, and that whatever happens to us is allowed because it's according to His will. If we've been disappointed in the past, if we've been hurt in the past, we could lose sight that God really does have an authority over us, and He has a plan for us, and that He always wants the best for us if we allow these things to overwhelm us. God and Jesus Christ have a goal for us. It's His kingdom. There is nothing in this life that we have here that's going to be there with us. Our job, our position, our wealth, our poverty, none of it's going to be in God's kingdom. The character that we're developing, that will be there. It gets down to a matter of trust. We could not be showing trust in God if we allow a self-centered attitude to march in front of us. Things happen to us that we don't want to happen. We get sick. We lose a job. Sadly, there are some born with disabilities. We can be disappointed, but none of these things justify being self-centered and demanding. Problems can fuel a demanding attitude, but never justify it. Never justify it. God is opposed to demands from His creation, no matter how severe the suffering. His ears are open wide to our cries and pleas for help. There's nothing wrong with that, but God doesn't deal with an angry person on His level. A demanding people. If things don't work out as we expect and we become angry and demanding, God doesn't respond. Because behind that is pride. And God opposes the proud, those who demand. But He gives grace, mercy, and care to the humble. There is a story in your book, somewhere in the Old Testament. But you already know where I'm headed. Story of Job. Let's move to the story of Job to understand what happened, which sometimes happens even to us, and how a self-centered, demanding spirit develops, and the solution for such a self-centered attitude. The book of Job is here for a purpose. What happened to Job has happened to others in the Bible and, unfortunately, over time, to us. But the book of Job, we have the thoughts and the conversations, the things that took place behind the scenes. It's a really unique book. Really is a unique book. In chapter 1, we see Job minding his own business, going about his life. We also see We also see that decisions about the events on earth were decided by powerful beings. God is the one in complete and total control of the universe, and His will stands. It's interesting to note that Satan, small s, Lucifer, had to go and give an accounting of his activities before God. I often point out the controversy in Hollywood that there is a great fight between Satan and God. There's no fight. Satan doesn't have the power to fight God. God is in total control. Decisions about Job were also made and approved. And some, by our standards, had devastating effects. I chatted with one person who just could not get over what Job went through that God allowed. And it was a stumbling block. It was a stumbling block. First, what took place for Job? He lost his source of wealth. His oxen and his donkeys and were taken from him, and those servants tending them were killed. The second, lightning kills all of the sheep and those tending them. Then raiders came and stole his camels and killed his servants. Then there was the house where his children were dining. And the house collapsed. Here we have a person who was financially ruined and lost all his children. And he responded by falling to the ground and worshiping God and saying, Job 1:21, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." All of this hit all at once, and his first reaction was to give God praise. Job's immediate response showed a solid perspective and a right attitude. I am God's creation. I am his servant. He can do what he wants. I'm just a created being. That's the position he took right at the very beginning of this enormous trial. He recognized that everything comes from God and can go back to God. That God had the power and authority to require it all back because it all came from him. Well, Satan small s wasn't done with Job. Big J. That didn't sound right. If I ever write you about Satan, you'll see that I never capitalize that name. Even when I send material back to the home office, I just can't. But it doesn't sound right to call Job the big J. Just... That wasn't enough. Satan then takes Job's health away. At work that we have this kind of joke. If you don't have your health, you don't have anything. And some of the guys who retire have amassed fortunes and have put together whatevers because they're very astute with money things. I wish I were. But then they don't have health. Satan takes Job's health away. He had been wealthy and healthy. Now he was diseased as well as an impoverished man, having just buried all 10 of his kids. And all of this happened with God's permission. If ever a man's life didn't support the gospel of health, wealth, and happiness and prosperity, it was Job. Still, Job responded with maturity. Job 2, verse 9. Job 2, verse 9. And I started here because sometimes we think that maybe his wife was being really cynical. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" And all this Job did not sin with his lips. Job's initial response to tragedy was mature. No hint of a self-centered, demanding attitude or a spirit of complaint or self-pity. And his wife, out of compassion, see, I have a different view. I don't think she was just being cynical. I think she had a great pathos for her husband, where the agony he was going through, just do what you need to do and get out of pain. I could feel that from the inside of her words. Just curse God and die. And he said, no. God can give good and God can give bad. Job's initial response to tragedy was mature. Now, as it often works, in the immediate aftermath of difficult times, we manage to mobilize our resources and cling to God as we press forward with hope and trust. But sometimes the strength to deal with tough times comes more from a strong hope that a good response on our part will bring a quicker end to our trials. If only I respond well, things will go away. You know, God, I've learned my lesson from these difficulties. See how well I'm doing. It's okay to make things better for me now. There was one time I got into some bad food or something. And I remember living next to the porcelain throne. And I called an elder, a very close friend of mine. I said, "I'm calling in all my markers. Come on over and do the funeral now because I'm dead. Blah, blah, blah. And I wondered why. Why didn't God relieve me? I prayed. I begged for mercy. I don't know. God allowed the whole body to rid itself of whatever that was. The longer we wait for hoped for relief, the greater the struggle becomes to trust in God's goodness. And this is what happened to Job. Job 2, verse 11. Job's friends came, they sat and just waited for Job. You know, last time we talked about the fourth friend, Elihu, that all of us should be an Elihu friend to one another. Job 2, verse 11. Now then, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. I won't even try Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. These really were friends. They loved Job. They cared for him. And when they raised their eyes from afar, they did not recognize him. They lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was great. It was huge. 7 days, a week. And you could think Job was pondering, what happened to me? Why did it happen? What did I do? Is this deserved? What's wrong? If, why, what? And finally, chapter 3, verse 1, and after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, may the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived, that the day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. Job was hurting, and he finally began to vent. And finally began to vent his pain. As we begin to see how Job handles his problems, we need to keep in mind one important principle. When things don't go well, and especially for an extended time, when our heart is filled with more pain than joy, the temptation to let our desire for relief becomes more demanding. It becomes a demand is strongest. The more severe the pain, the stronger the temptation to get into this self-centered attitude and looking for relief. His friends talk to him. Eliphaz encouraged the tendency in Job to demand by suggesting that he take his case before God. He was enabling Job to think from a self-centered standpoint. Job 5, verse 8. Here Eliphaz is speaking, and he says, but as for me, you can almost see the pontification, the finger coming up, and the pride here a little bit. But as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause. I would bring my case to God. I would bring my case before the court of heaven. These guys knew Job. They knew his character. They knew him to be a man of God. And here Eliphaz was suggesting, take your case to God. You may have a case. Bildad adds to the same idea, Job 8. Job 8, verse 5 and 6. If you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely He would awake for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place. Call on God with a pure heart. God would rouse Himself. Obviously, He's asleep. He's not watching what took place to you. He didn't see what happened to you. His back was turned. Yeah, right. Zophar. Oh, I'm so tempted to say. Oh, I will. So far, so good. Zophar. You got to stop me. Not. Chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 13. Zophar takes the same tack, but from a different slant. Verse 13. If you would prepare your heart, stretch out your hands toward Him, if iniquity were in your hand, and you put it far away, and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents, then surely you would lift up your face without spot. Yes, you could be steadfast and not fear. Zophar was accusing Job of harboring some evil in his life and assured him that if he gets rid of his sin and recommits, rededicates his life to God, God would surely remove his shame. You know, much of what the three friends said was good. Nothing wrong about taking our case to God. Nothing wrong about going to God with a pure heart. Nothing wrong with about if we have sin on our hands to ask God to forgive us. We repent. But none understood nor addressed the problem that Job was experiencing. Each was looking for a way out of Job's trouble without taking the precaution against a demanding, self-centered attitude. They were saying, if you do this, then God will give you that. If you do this, then God will do that. Just follow the formula. and everything will be okay. Just follow the formula. Job turns down the advice, actually. He understands what they were saying, but he turned down their advice. Back a couple of chapters, Job 9, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, "Truly, I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand." No matter how good a cause, you can't force God to respond. God is not a man that he has to respond. So the trial continued for Job without promise or prospect of relief. In our lives, sometimes when our prayers go unanswered for longer than we expect, our confidence is sometimes shaken. Trust can give way to the exposition of a self-centered, demanding attitude. When our prayers go unanswered for longer than we expect, we could end up with a self-centered, demanding attitude. Job 10, verse 1. Job is now changing a little bit. Remember, his first response was to say, "God is righteous. Regardless of what I had, God could require it all back." Chapter 10, verse 1. "My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, 'Do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me.'" Whoa. Different attitude. Completely different attitude now. The trial remains unabated, and Job appears more desperate for answers. He's showing a very different tone than from chapter 1. Job 13, verse 1. "Behold, my eyes have seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God." I want to present my case to God. It really comes out now. Job has a different attitude for one already who has already dismissed the idea of God as being futile. Remember, he said, not one case out of a thousand. He says, you can't force God to give a response because he's God. Now he's saying, I want to contend with, I want to talk to God, I want a desire, I want to reason with God. His pain continued and his attitude dipped. To go this far, Job had to believe that he had, that what he had, correction, To go this far, Job had to believe that what he was after was deserved and legitimate, and that there was a solid basis for his demands. Verse 15. "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. He can kill me. He can take my life. He can demand my existence. But I will defend my life. Why? Because I'm right. I know I'm right. Why has all this happened to me? This is undeserved." Verse 18. "See, now I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish. I'm ready. I'm prepared. I'm ready to speak. I want to talk to God. If I hold it in any longer, I'll explode." Job was now convinced over time that he had a case. No longer was he praying for help. No longer was he asking for wisdom and understanding. No longer was he asking for intervention and relief. Now he wanted an explanation. I want an explanation as to why this happened. And he's talking to the sovereign of the universe. He better have a whole case of depends. He has gone from submitting to God's plan to asserting that he deserves better treatment than he's been receiving. If God takes his life, if the facts be known, it would be clear to all that he had been mistreated. Even if God takes his life. Each of us has been the victim of someone else's sinfulness. We've all been mistreated. None of us are exempt from such an experience, and it seems unfair at the time. It probably was. But when the hurt caused by others drives us not to trust God and not to return love for evil, but rather to demand relief, then God's failure to cooperate with our demands makes him seem less like our protector and more like an enemy. Let me state that again. When God doesn't cooperate with our desire for relief, it puts him on a different plane in our minds. Job 16. Notice how Job's perception of God continues to change. Job 16, verse 6. Though I speak, my grief is not relieved. And if I remain silent, how am I eased? But now he has worn me out. You have made desolation all my company. You have shriveled me up, and it is a witness against me. My leanness rises up against me and bears witness to my face. He tears me in his wrath and hates me. He gnashes at me with his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze upon me. This is a different attitude. Whoa, this is from God, the loving God, the caring God, to an enemy, an adversary? The perception is that God has become an uncaring individual. Perhaps part of our problems is that we face definite plans for achieving happiness, or at least finding relief, and those plans are so deeply embedded in our makeup that we never question them. And when they don't happen, we end up frustrated and angry. We tend to measure the love of others by the degree that they cooperate with our plans. We tend to measure the love of others by the degree of their cooperation with our plans. God's refusal to help us with our goals, our way, and his insistence that we yield to his plans, his way, can make him appear to be unconcerned about our happiness, which is not the case. At which point, the heavens are no higher than the ceiling above which our prayers never rise. Because our attitude, well, it's pride-filled. We try to get God to see things our way, to see how unfair things are. And he looks down from heaven and he says, looks okay to me. Have you ever thought about that? The situation you find yourself in, as difficult as it is, and don't get me wrong, it's difficult and it can be frustrating and it can be angry and it can be whole everything. And our Father looks down and says, looks okay to me, because he has a plan. His plan isn't to give us this world, this physical world. His plan is to get us into his kingdom. And when he looks down on us and he says, looks okay to me, it's because he's working his plan in our lives. Philippians 1:6. I love that scripture. That once he starts a life in you, he's going to complete it until the return of Christ. Philippians 1:6. Wonderful scripture. I love that phrase, it looks okay to me. Otherwise, God is incapable of managing the world around us. Your back was turned and this happened to me. Now what? God's back was to me and this happened and he didn't know it happened. Boy, that's some God, huh? Job experienced a progression of emotions and perception that we can identify with. We can see that over time our attitudes can also go the wrong way. Job 17. If you haven't noticed, we're going to go quickly through the book of Job. Job 17, verse 6. But he has made me a byword of the people, and I have become one in whose face men spit. I have been despised by the people around me. My eye has also grown dim because of sorrow, and my members are like shadows. Upright men are astonished at this, and the innocent stirs himself up against the hypocrite. Yet the righteous will hold to his way. He who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger. Job's conviction that the weight of morality was on his side, and it was growing. The weight of morality was on his side, and it was growing. In Job's mind, the evidence was piling up. His case was getting stronger and stronger, and yet God remained unimpressed. Oh, I'm going to start using God with a small g because he cannot be talking about the God. Job 19. Job 19. Verse 1. Then Job answered and said, "How long will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have reproached me. You are not ashamed that you have wronged me. And if indeed I have erred, my error remains with me. If indeed you exalt yourselves against me, plead my disgrace against me, know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. Know then that God has wronged me and surrounded me with his net. If I cry out concerning wrong, I am not heard. If I cry out, there is no justice." Whoa. He has come a long way from an initial correct response that God can give, God can take. God is God of all, sovereign of the universe. People can give up on God. When the ultimate source of power refuses to take up our just cause, our way, then whatever is required to find relief seems almost entirely warranted. How can you blame a starving man through no fault of his own that he steals food? There's so many examples of people who justify their actions based on the situation. How can something be so wrong, as the song goes, when it seems so right? Well, it's wrong because it's wrong. And we've become a demanding, self-centered people. The pain, the hurt people experience justifies an attitude or an action. The weight of morality is on their side, therefore they tend to get into trouble and into sin. When there is no relief from the struggle, our pain tends to blur the lines of moral distinction. Things that are clearly wrong become less offensive to our conscience when they provide our only hope of relief. Situation ethics. Situation ethics. We sometimes prepare to do anything to get relief, including foolish things. Notice the problem. It's not the hurt. It's okay to hurt. It's not the desire for relief and satisfaction. We know that there has to be more out there than the pain we're experiencing. It's the self-centered demand, the demand that it's our way now. I'm sure Job felt day 2, sitting in that ash heap, he needed relief now. Day 3, day 4. I need that relief now. It's the demand. When we demand relief from our pain now, we're in danger of slipping from ethical behavior to pragmatic action. Whatever addresses and eases our pain is justified. And this is where Job is headed. And often, the result is compromise. People can find very good reasons in their own minds for going down a certain road. Wrong is never justified when it's wrong against God's law. But there are times when people will try and justify going wrong because of the situation. Not willing to sin is an obvious manner. Yet people sometimes continue to seek to get God to recognize the reasonableness of their demands. And less obvious is the self-centered demanding attitude, the holding of negative attitudes. Job still had a bit to learn. Job 23. Job 23. Verse 1. Then Job answered and said, "Even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me and with his great power? No, but he would take note of me. There the upright could reason with him and I would be delivered forever from my judge." Whoa. Many of us live in hope that one day we'll be able to get God to see our cause. Because we're just so right. And he's up there, looks good to me. Because God's back was never to us. Verse 13. But he is unique, and who can make him change? And whatever his soul desires, that he does. For he performs what is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Therefore, I am terrified at his presence. When I consider this, I am afraid of him. Job's admission that God does what he does because he's God, conceding that he doesn't have to do what appears right to us because he is God. But notice something else. He's at the point now where he fears God. I've often said how wonderful it is to be in the hands of the living God when you're right with him. You know, there's that scripture, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. That's because you're not in concert with him. But when you're in concert with him, it's a wonderful thing. That's your Father. That's the sovereign of the universe. He has all the power to take care of you. And at this point, Job has stepped away from that. He has gotten to the point where he fears God. This then can lead to doubt and lack of trust toward God. It can lead to a demanding spirit and an angry despair, sort of like, God may not come through. Probably won't. But he should. It's more of a hope than a trust. Then it goes into, how can he treat me this way? I'll just press on, even though I hurt. I'll just have to go on. Surely God will eventually see what I'm going through. A self-centered, demanding spirit is offensive to God. Christian growth requires that we remove the tendency to demand. Otherwise, deep personal change just cannot take place. At this point, if Job could have had a chat with God, do you think God might say, you know, you have a point, Job. I didn't see it this way. I didn't see it from your point of view. I made a bit of an error. Yeah, I'll straighten it out right away. Can you imagine the conversation going that way? The sovereign of the universe, who knows everything, has all power, saying, Job, I didn't see it from your perspective. You're right. I should have handled this better. How foolish we can become when our trials continue and we lose sight of God as being our true power, allowing what takes place. Put that way, a demanding spirit, a demanding attitude appears absurd. But that was what Job was saying. Thankfully, finally, in the book, God did grant Job the audience he so badly wanted. Isn't it a terrible thing sometimes to get exactly what you ask for? Well, the audience didn't go exactly the way Job hoped. Let's go to jump a few pages to Job 38. Job 38. Verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, you want an answer, Job? Here's answers. Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? This doesn't seem like a friendly conversation taking place. Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. It wasn't a question of you may answer me. You're going to give an answer. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have an understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. And he goes on and on. The first step in humility is considering who it is we think must change. A demand that things be different is nothing more than an accusation against God. A charge that he is guilty of mismanagement and negligence in his duty in running things. And God is saying, where were you? I created this all. Nothing happens without my knowledge, my understanding. Verse 12. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it may take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It takes on the form the clay under its seal and stands out like garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. Hey, where have you been? Verse 19, have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know this. I think today we still don't know the full breadth of this world. Not even close. The first examination came to an end when God issued Job the challenge. Where were you? Okay. Job 40, verse 2. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. You think I mismanaged the universe? Explain it to me." Verse 3, then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay at my hand across my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yet twice I will proceed no further." The demand is gone. Nope, I said enough. I didn't know what I was saying. Then the Lord answered Job, verse 6, out of the whirlwind and said, "Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer." You're not off the hook. You're going to give me an answer. "Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified?" Only God can say what is right and wrong and what is justified. We have no position to demand that. Verse 41, verse 34. "He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. I know nothing gets by you. The proud demand, assuming that they are right." The proud demand and assume that they are right. Nothing gets by you. The foundation for any relationship with God is recognition that God is God and we are not. And we have no business demanding anything from God, or anyone for that matter, however fervently our soul longs for relief from pain. Let's notice that Job has finally changed from the inside out. Job 42. Notice Job is now answering completely and totally correctly. He's gone this whole route from correct response, hoping response. "I may have a case. I have a case. I want to talk to God. I'm going to contend with..." Oh boy, God's asking me questions. I'm not going to say anything. No, you're going to demand an answer from me. Okay. Job 42, verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, 'Who is this who hides counsel without knowledge?' Therefore I uttered what I did not understand." Job was a brilliant man. He was a brilliant man. He now understood that he uttered things that he did not understand. "Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, 'I will question you and you shall answer me.' Finally, I have heard of you by the hearing of my ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes," which is kind of convenient because that's where he was. "It wasn't that I heard the stories. It wasn't that I now see you." And when he talks about seeing, we're talking about seeing in the mind and the heart. He sees him from the inside out. That self-centered, demanding attitude is replaced by repentance and humility. Certainly, he was a different man, far different than the demander of the past. What do we learn from this wonderful story of Job? It's okay to petition God for change and help and relief, to plead with passion and energy, but it's just not okay to demand that the will of the Almighty be in concert with our own. Nothing is wrong with confidence that God can satisfy the desires of a heart that delights in Him. Delighting in God involves a total and complete surrender to His will, to His care. Such surrender cannot coexist with a self-centered, demanding attitude. Jesus faced this in the garden just before being taken to be crucified. What did He say? He said, "Not my will, but your will be done." Whatever it takes to satisfy the plan that we put together, not my will, but your will. There are times we just need to ask, have I placed myself totally and completely in God's hands? Is my relationship one of total trust, where I am at peace with God's will in my life, that I accept God's will totally in my life? The events in our lives may not be what we want. It may not be what we choose, but we should never let it lead us to engaging and exercising a self-centered attitude or a demanding spirit. For we know we do have a loving Father. We know we do have a caring parent who looks out for our best interests. We know that we do have an advocate before the throne of grace, applying the sacrifice that Jesus Christ made on our behalf. These are real. These are things we can trust in. We also know all things work together. They do work together for those who love God and to those who are called according to His purpose. Romans 8:28. Well, you know what? All things worked out for Job. And all things can and will work out for us. It's been a pleasure. We will see you here the first week of September. This is August, right? Yes. So we'll see you in a month.